Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
All right, mark it on your calendars. The December 31st issue of Newsweek is the last one you'll be able to buy at the airport or wherever else people buy magazines these days. Last week's announcement had lots of readers wondering what happens to the rest of the newsstand. We will get two views now. Joining us are Stephen Shepard. He's the founding dean of the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He writes about his time as an editor at Newsweek and as editor-in-chief of Businessweek in his new memoir, Deadlines and Disruptions, My Turbulent Path from Print to Digital. And joining us from the West Coast, Bob Garfield, co-host of NPR's On the Media. He sought solutions to the journalism funding crisis in his book, The Chaos Scenario, and his novel, Bedfellows, is out this month. Hi, Steve. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Hi, Brian. And hello, Steve.
So, Stephen Shepard, at the end of your book, you suggest that newspapers and magazines should start going the way of all digital. At the same time, you were an editor at Newsweek when it was in its heyday. So did the news about Newsweek surprise you?
It didn't surprise me, but it certainly saddened me. But I think that the conclusion a lot of people are drawing is not correct, they just say that in this day and age of 24-hour news cycles and Twitter and Facebook, what good is a weekly magazine? And I think that that's not correct because there are plenty of weekly magazines that are doing just fine, thank you. The Economist, The Week, The New Yorker, New York Magazine, and even Time Magazine, Newsweek's direct rival, was named Magazine of the Year and is profitable. So I think you have to ask the question, why is Time profitable and doing reasonably well in a difficult time and Newsweek is failing? And I think the answer is that the magazine simply wasn't good enough. And this goes back before Tina Brown. There was a period of decline. And in this day and age, not even a great magazine is guaranteed to succeed, but a weak magazine will surely fail. And that's what I think happened to Newsweek.
And Bob Garfield, I've got some of the numbers here that Steve was just referring to. Newsweek's print advertising fell 70% between 2007 and 2011. Contrast that to Time's print advertising, which fell just 20% during the same period, and advertising at The Economist rose 20%. How do you account for the difference? Is it just quality of content?
Yeah, it's just quality of content. Newsweek is. It's not been a strong magazine for some time. Despite a truly sterling heritage, some great journalism has been in its pages over the last, whatever it is, almost 80 years. But the magazine has struggled to find itself editorially against the headwinds of a marketplace that is going to be unkind to everyone in the magazine business. Though Time is doing relatively well at the moment, I don't think it is going to exist in print indefinitely. I think there is a guillotine blade over its neck as well.
And I understand that you, Bob, see the new model for Newsweek, the digital model, as virtually the same as the old print model from the business standpoint. In other words, totally untenable and unlikely to make any money. Do you generalize from there to magazines that go digital in general?
Yeah, I wouldn't say totally untenable. I would say totally and completely and absolutely untenable. And
but what do you really think?
The situation is pretty simple. There is an almost infinite amount of content online, and that's called supply. And as a consequence, the prices, when the supply is infinite, are driven down. And advertising dollars that a publisher can fetch online are literally pennies on the dollar compared to what they could have fetched in print. Now, the cost of print production and the time lag is a killer in and of itself. But once you convert to an all-digital platform, you're facing an advertising market that simply cannot keep the lights on. And Barry Diller has decided with Newsweek to make it a pay-only publication. And I simply cannot imagine that it will hold on to its significant percentage of its subscribers behind a paywall. I simply can't imagine it.
Steve Shepard, why this is important, as I don't have to tell you, is because journalism matters, and there has to be a mechanism for funding actual reporting, not just people writing commentary and blogging and tweeting. We talked about that a lot during our membership drive, which just ended, that, of course, we've got a not-for-profit funding model here to fund actual reporting at WNYC. But in the print world, in your book, you write that web-based advertising is unlikely to be adequate to support digital journalism. But are you as pessimistic as Bob that there's nothing on the horizon because of supply and demand that could fund real journalism based on the web to the extent that old journalism was funded?
Yeah, I think there is something on the horizon. I agree with Bob, and as I said in my book, that web-based advertising in the foreseeable future, the ad rates are just too low to support quality journalism in the digital age. But the new thing on the horizon are, of course, the tablet computers. The tablet computer is a lean-back device, which is very consistent with the way weekly and monthly magazines are consumed. You read them as leisure time things. And the iPad, for example, is used at home, in bedrooms. People curl up in bed. They read it in the morning. They read it in the evening. It's very compatible with magazines. And it offers the opportunity to get ad rates up if publishers will take advantage of what this medium offers, which is personalization and targeting of ads to consumers. And I think that, you know, the use of video on tablet computers, for example, will fetch higher advertising rates. So I think there's more than a glimmer of hope that iPads and other tablets, particularly for magazines, which are leisure reads, will be very helpful and change the business model away from the web-based pennies on the dollar medium that Bob is talking about. He's right about the web, but the tablet is something new and different and more hopeful.
Bob, what do you think about that, and what do you think about the paywall model? People used to cry, the Internet is free, the Internet should be free, how dare you charge us for anything? And now I think at least people in the journalism business and maybe the general public are starting to realize, well, we used to pay for newspapers and magazines and the print editions. Maybe it's only right that we pay something for access to some professional news organizations online to fund the journalism.
It is only right. And for 300 years, people understood the quid pro quo, that for free or subsidized content, you put up with advertising and you pay a little subscription price as well, or plunk down $3 at the newsstand. But the venture capitalists and monks who have funded the Internet and given it away for free for the entirety of its existence till now have trained the world to think somehow that content is free. And this is unsustainable. And I agree with Steve that the iPad and other tablet devices do give us a glimmer of hope. And targeted advertising equally gives us a glimmer of hope because the prices fetched by publishers with targeted advertising are significantly higher, sometimes by a multiple of 4, 5, or even 10 compared to just run-of-the-mill advertising. But there is, because of privacy issues, we are always right on the brink of targeted advertising being legislated or regulated right into oblivion, killing the goose that could potentially save... Wait, that's not right. Killing the goose that lays the golden egg. Targeted advertising could save the goose, but if the Congress goes the way of the EU, publishers could be, you know, just in more trouble still.
And Stephen Shepard, as you describe in your memoirs, you had a front row seat for the Business Week crisis when you were asked for advice from your former employers there. You had been editor-in-chief. And I'm curious, of all the options on the table at the time, it was Bloomberg, Mayor Bloomberg, who stepped forward, and his company anyway, bought the magazine for $5 million, chump change in publishing. So how does that model work? How does Business Week stay profitable now? And, you know, talk about what was interesting in your experience there.
Well, when it became clear that McGraw-Hill could not sustain the big losses that Business Week was experiencing, they were looking for a buyer, and fortunately, Michael Bloomberg stepped up, and Bloomberg is proving to be a good home for Businessweek. It's a much improved magazine from the deterioration that had set in. Their losses have been trimmed, although they're still not making money. So it's great if you can get an owner who is a billionaire and is willing to subsidize the losses until they figure out the new world. So, you know, it's better than the alternative, which was that it was going to be shut down, which is what happened to Newsweek and U.S. News as a weekly magazine. I just want to raise one other point, which has to do with getting people to pay for content. Mm-hmm. If you look at the experience of newspapers, the metering system is actually working surprisingly well for a number of papers. There are about 1,400 newspapers in the United States, and about 20% of them now have some kind of a metering system in which they charge users for digital content. The most spectacular success, of course, is the New York Times. The big surprise here is that everybody told us that traffic would fall off if you started charging people for content. And the experience of not just the New York Times but other newspapers is that in unique visitors it doesn't fall at all, and in paid views it falls on the order of 10%. And people are starting to make money and create new revenue streams from charging readers for online content. And I think this is another hopeful sign that we've reversed what Bob was talking about. This many years of people telling us you can't charge for content is now being disproven by the effective use of metering models on newspapers.
And just put on your dean of the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism hat for a second. What are you telling young aspiring journalists? And I think it's both amazing and hopeful that there's such demand for spots in journalism schools, even since this crisis started in earnest a few years ago. But what do you tell the young journalists starting their careers at a time when there is still so much uncertainty about funding models for potential employees?
Yeah, these are graduate students, average age 26. They know what they're getting themselves into, and they're doing it for one reason, and it's the same as our generation. They want to be journalists. They have a passion for journalism, and they know that there's something new to learn for the first time probably since the advent of broadcast news. So they're coming and knowing that they have to learn both sets of skills, the eternal verities of good reporting and writing and ethical values and critical thinking, married to, converged with, the new world of interactivity, multimedia, social media, and so on. So they know they have to learn all this, and they're getting jobs. So we're very optimistic. The demand for spots is very strong here and at other graduate programs in journalism. So these students are not giving up, and they're going to be the ones who reimagine the future and figure out the new business models. And there are enough hopeful signs that I think they're going to be satisfied and they'll have good careers.
We don't even have time for Bob Garfield to say bah humbug, if you were going to say that. But he's the author of The Chaos Scenario. Stephen Shepard from CUNY Graduate School is the author now of Deadlines and Disruptions, My Turbulent Path from Print to Digital. Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much, Brian.